Hello, everyone, and such a warm welcome to you. This is Molly Rowan Leach, and I'm privileged to be the founder and host of Restorative Justice on the Rise. I'm not the only host these days. Over the years, we've been privileged to have guest hosts, and we also have a team of people that are branching out into youth-focused podcasting at this moment. It's been a privilege to be here supporting the global movement of restorative justice for 15 years. And just a quick shout out also to Troy Williams of Restorative Media, who, alongside Restorative Justice on the Rise, was one of the first restorative justice podcasts existing on the planet. And we take that to be something that's quite a responsibility, to lift up voices from all around the world to create public platforms for your engagement. So we hope you'll join us at some point for our upcoming live panels and events. And for more information about Restorative Justice on the Rise, simply go to restorativejusticeontherise.org. You can find our robust archives at Apple and at Spotify. And of course, they are also floating around on other platforms. We also have a lot of publications, essays, and research posted online. So please visit us. Please join our community as you wish. We're looking forward to today's conversation with Mika Dashman. And I have to say that this is an absolute honor, first of all, to be with Mika. And it's rather overdue, in that we've actually been along the road together in many ways, working alongside each other and collaboratively supporting each other's work. So for that, I'm grateful deeply. And also, today we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Restorative Justice Initiative, for which Mika is the founder. I want to just say a little bit from Kay Prannis about the Restorative Justice Initiative before we go into this conversation with our very special guest, Mika Dashman. Kay says, RJI builds community. When I am contacted by people who want to know what is going on in New York and want to connect to practitioners there, I always refer them to Restorative Justice Initiative. RJI has played an important role in connecting and convening people interested in restorative justice. I am so grateful that RJI exists. And of course, I love Kay as a mentor and teacher in this field so much. And I also would just add, from my perspective of being in this field for 2 decades, that there's something even greater than New York that you've inspired, Mika. And I'm going to introduce everyone to you, and then we're going to dive in. So a little bit about Mika. Mika is an attorney and restorative justice practitioner. She's also a New York State certified mediator and has mediated criminal court cases and facilitated community conferences through the New York Peace Institute. Mika facilitates peacemaking, community building circles for organizations, student and professional groups. She was awarded the David Lerman Memorial Fund's Fellowship in Restorative Justice by the Project for Integrating Law, Spirituality, and Politics in both 2015 and 2017. She's also a contributor to the 2021 anthology, Listening to the Movement: Essays on New Growth and New Challenges in Restorative Justice. Prior to beginning her work in alternative dispute resolution, Mika spent more than 6 years providing direct legal services to indigent individuals at several New York City nonprofits, including Housing Works Incorporated, where she also worked on all aspects of the agency's civil rights impact docket. Mika is a graduate of the City University of New York School of Law and Sarah Lawrence College. And for more information, I encourage you to, first of all, take two actions today as you're listening. Go to restorativejustice.nyc, that's restorativejustice.nyc, and I'd like to invite you to make a donation to celebrate their 10th year of being in service to this field in a way that is often extremely undervalued and underrated. Being a networker and a provider of connections for people empowers them. And I just celebrate you, Mika, for being the initiator. I know you're not in this alone. You have people surrounding you, but you planted a seed that it's been a joy and real honor to watch grow, and to the length that it has in the decade that you have been a nonprofit. So thanks for taking time to speak with us today and to speak with me, and really looking forward to seeing donations come in from the Restorative Justice on the Rise Network to support your 10-year fundraiser. Welcome.
Thank you, Molly. It's really great to be doing this with you after all of these years.
Right.
So, you know, I feel like it's a continuation of conversations that we've been having for a long time. And it's great to finally do it in front of in front of more people.
Yes.
You know, to bring more people into these conversations. So glad to be here with you.
And we just got done with a micro clip about the importance of restorative networks. And I'm curious, can we launch off a little bit more on that right up front together, if you're
mm-hmm.
willing? Can
mm-hmm.
you say a little bit more about your experience of, you know, what you've witnessed RJI become for practitioners? And why do you think, personally, as an expert, a guide, a nonprofit leader in this field, that it's so hard for networking platforms that are doing best practices work like yours, like RJI? You're collaborating, you're celebrating other people's work, you're doing on-the-ground work, you're offering events, trainings, you're doing so many things to unite people in this movement. Why is it that it's so hard to get funding?
Well, in a word, capitalism.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, because I think that the whole mindset around how we determine the value of this work or any work is that people are looking for very specific, concrete outcomes. They look for they want to know, you know, how have you helped people who are seen as being in need? You know, there's this real kind of like helping mindset in that pervades philanthropy.
Right.
And, you know, the way that I think about restorative justice is that restorative justice is for everyone. I mean, obviously, you know, there are specific ways that restorative justice can lift up and help to heal those among us who are most marginalized and most impacted by systemic oppression. But restorative justice at its core, it's about how we build relationships, how we live in community, our sense of shared responsibility, our shared values. And you know, it recognizes that harm and conflict between humans is inevitable. And rather than seeing that as something that needs to be fixed or resolved or cleaned up, you know, I think at its best, restorative justice sees conflict as an opportunity for learning and growth and transformation. And when we cause harm to each other, which we inevitably do, All of us, every single one of us, it is the nature of being human that we're all on both sides of the coin of harm at different points in our lives and in different relationships. So we've all experienced harm and we all cause harm. And so we all need the skills to take responsibility, acknowledge harm when we're the ones who are causing it, to acknowledge it, to take responsibility and to make amends. And we all want that for ourselves when we're on the receiving end of harm. And we don't have a lot of good models, certainly in the US, in the dominant culture in the US, we don't have a lot of good models for accountability for harm. We sort of only have punishment. That's our only model for accountability. And, what I often say to people when I speak publicly is, if you remember only one thing that I said here today, it's that I am on a mission to disentangle the concepts of punishment and accountability, because more often than not, punishment does not actually achieve accountability. And while you can't force somebody to take responsibility and take accountability for harm, we often use this term, holding, we need to, this person needs to be held accountable. We need to hold this person accountable. I don't think accountability can be coerced, but I do think that there are conditions that we can create that make it more likely that when we cause harm, we can take responsibility for it and make amends. And I think,
Can I just use a yellow highlighter pin on that, please? Excuse me for interrupting you, but like for our listeners, what you just said is extraordinarily profound in all of it, all the aspects. But I want to hone in on this point that you make about holding accountable, like you said, is almost a gesture of enforcement, right? It is a gesture of like enforcing someone to be accountable. And yet can you can you're so articulate with this, but this is at the root of best, like really well cultivated practices, is doing something other than holding accountable while still offering what might be called accountability and valuing it, right? Like, so how does someone as a practitioner step into this and understand that we're cultivating these conditions to arise from within the what we term offender? I don't use the language of offender and victim other than for clarity, but how would you articulate that, Mika? It's such an
It's,
important point.
yeah, it starts with building a relationship and building trust, right? I mean, we all feel a tremendous amount of shame, and there's so much when we cause harm, and there's so much stigma associated with causing harm. And if you believe that if you take responsibility, you're going to be shunned and ostracized and ejected from your community, you're going to lose your relationships, and you're going to be hurt even more than you've probably already been hurt, why would you ever take responsibility? So the role of a
Yeah,
restorative
but true.
facilitator or facilitators is to call people in, and to create enough safety and enough trust that people can actually face and grapple with the consequences and the impact of their actions.
I don't know that I've ever heard a colleague in this field speak to it. So, I mean, and there's so many amazing people in this field. So, cheers to everybody. Thank you to the listeners who are offering on the ground restorative process of any kind. It's not just conflict related, as we know, right? It's also about, like you said, simply coming together around finding and discovering our common ground and values and celebrating and building community. And I'm curious, I want to like step back for a moment and just remember to share with listeners from your perspective, the range of work that that has developed over 10 years with the Restorative Justice Initiative. And if you might segue a little bit into the origin story, even like backing up even before that moment that you got 501c3 status 10 years ago, what was that origin story for you? You have so many talents in criminal justice and, you know, as an attorney and also a hands-on practitioner of many forms of mediation and dispute resolution. So would you be willing to share with us the origin story of RJI as well?
Yeah, well, I first heard the term restorative justice in 2013. I was introduced to it through an article in the New York Times about what's now a pretty well-known and well-publicized restorative justice plea conference that Sujatha Baliga facilitated in a murder case in Tallahassee, Florida.
I remember that one.
And I was so moved by that particular story. I know you know the one that I'm referring to, and feel free to link to that New York Times article in the show notes if you think others would like to see it who haven't. I was so moved by that story, and I was really struck by the idea that if, people, parents in this case who have suffered, the most unimaginable loss, the loss of a child, could have that instinct to find it in their hearts to forgive, but also have the clarity to know that the person that took their daughter's life owed a debt, had a responsibility, and they were going to help him. They wanted to help him to fulfill that responsibility. And that act of generosity was so moving to me, and I felt like if people in that situation have that instinct, can have that instinct and look for that kind of a process that would make that possible, then this has much broader implications and applications. Right? Because the thing about crime is, and I try to use, I am a lawyer by training, but I try to use the term harm. I prefer to use the term harm instead of crime. And I'll tell you why. And then I'll get back to the origin story because I know this is a little bit of a tangent. But, in the criminal legal system, in this country, criminalizes all sorts of things that don't actually harm other people. And at the same time, there are many forms of harm that are not criminalized or for which people evade, responsibility within the, within the context of that system. So, I think restorative justice has much broader implications and applications. But if in the case of homicide, people can come together and have this deeply human, and truthful and connected dialogue and say, even though you harmed me, I want to remain in relationship with you and I am invested in your healing and your future, then to me, that speaks to the resiliency of the human spirit. And I think that these kinds of processes should be much more widely available. When people have this instinct, they should be able to know this is who I contact, this is how I get started, this is how I can seek out a restorative process. And so
And that's
in
the role
20,
that RJI plays, which is huge. Excuse me, I
right.
want you to go back to that origin story, but let me just say, just
Yeah.
from watching what you've done, it has direct impact. RJI has direct impact in the critical aspect of advocacy for the why. It answers to the why, and it also answers to the like where and who. Like you refer people who are working best practices, seasoned practitioners. I mean, you have a whole palette of really critical pieces that you're offering. And here in Colorado, where I'm sitting right now, we have a bill, not, excuse me, we have a legal stipulation, and I can't remember the House bill number, but it provides the legalized access to restorative justice. And Mika, you could probably speak to it more clearly than I can. But in essence, part of what we're missing in the field still, or like we don't have a strong muscle in, is that can be strengthened is because of organizations like you and RJI doing the advocacy work that says, hey, wait a minute, this is actually safe for me to approach as a victim. This is, and here's the reasons why. And so maybe I would want to consider it here in Colorado because I know, I know and trust RJI for the white papers, the best practices documentation. Colorado also has those, but the missing link is getting those in front of people who need, need this information for their consideration.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. I mean, we serve as a hub, as an information clearinghouse, as a point of entry. It was important to me early on to build a website that had good SEO. So, a lot of times when I ask people, how did you find us? They say, well, I Googled restorative justice in New York City and I found Restorative Justice Initiative, and that's very much by design. So before there was Restorative Justice Initiative, back in 2013 or 2014, as I was building relationships with other people in outside, first outside of New York City, but eventually found my way to practitioners within New York. There was an informal network of restorative justice practitioners and advocates who had been convening for a few years since Occupy Wall Street, where Kay had come during Occupy Wall Street. Kay Prentice had come and done some circle keeping training. And so there was this informal network that had grown from there, that was meeting every once in a while, And they were really trying to think about restorative justice movement building in New York and how to support that. And so that network eventually, it was a volunteer run network. And one story that I'll share is that I remember early on in one of those meetings of that group of practitioners, somebody was on the call who's the executive director of a restorative justice-based diversion program here in New York. And I'll never forget, she said, people call us and email us, several times a week to say, I love your work. How can I get involved? I want to get involved. Can I, are you hiring? Can I volunteer? Can I intern with you? And she said, I don't have time to respond to any of those people. And I wish we had someone, here in New York who could respond to those people. And I really took that to heart and I agreed with her. I thought that we needed an entity that could be responsive to that curiosity and, people who were reaching out because they felt an affinity, they felt a calling toward this work, but they just weren't sure how to plug in, how to get involved. New York is a big city. It can
Exactly.
be intimidating. It can be hard to build relationships, where you don't already have them. It can be hard to break out of your silo, which I will say is another big part of our mission at RJI, is to really break down silos. So it was very important to me from the beginning that Restorative Justice Initiative would work citywide. We would be a citywide network, but we would also be a cross-sector or cross-application network, right? So some restorative justice networks are focused only on restorative practices in schools, in education, K through 12 education. Some are focused only on the work in the context of the criminal legal system. And I really thought that we needed to be connecting and convening New Yorkers who were working in and out of systems at the grassroots community level and also within those systems. Because, among other reasons, we know about the school to prison pipeline. We know that those systems are interconnected, those instincts toward punishment and retribution are interconnected, and they tend to impact the same communities throughout. There's a through line. So, how are we going to disrupt the school to prison pipeline if the people who have, alternatives or who have another better way of addressing conflict and harm and creating meaningful accountability are not, in schools, in the criminal legal system, in community, if those folks are not speaking to each other? So that's what we wanted to do at JI from the beginning, was to build a network that brought New Yorkers who are utilizing these practices in a range of different contexts together, who might not otherwise ever be in the same room or at the same table, even though they have shared values and practices that they're engaging with.
Yeah, so as you noted, like with that anecdote of the phone call and the emails that come in to the colleague doing the community conferencing, grassroots work offering RJ services, that I mean, like high pressure environment, low funding, understaffed, not able to respond to people who are hungry and ready to participate and even to train up to become facilitators themselves, right? So I just want to like highlight that for again for our listeners of please support RJI by making a donation. We're talking with Mika Dashman of the Restorative Justice Initiative. What they are doing at RJI is the fabric that weaves good best practices, world-class trainers and guides who are humble and seasoned and who you know have sat in many types of circles, a directory of resources and of other programs, and also one of the most important things of bringing people in this field together instead of there being a tendency to silo. One of the big restorative justice pandemics of sorts, not to under like not to I don't mean any harm using that phrase, but like we are so siloed in this field in so many different ways, and a conference here and there is great. It's so beautiful to get together with like-minded professionals and individuals, but we're talking this is a sustained effort every day, business day of the week, 5 days a week. That's what Mika and all of the team at RJI are doing is providing the glue for you to find what you need in order to get involved in this movement. And that's the only way it grows.
Yeah, thanks, Molly. And you had asked me a question earlier about sort of the growth of the
Yes.
organization. So, if now is a good time, I can talk a little bit about how we branched into
Yes.
trainings and
Yes,
youth
please.
leadership development.
Yeah, we definitely want to dive into that right now. And I just want to premise that with I've known you, Mika, since the beginning. And I think I mentioned this earlier. It really is a fulfilling, wonderful feeling to observe an organization at its birth and into its 10th year now. So, and how you've grown. And I think it would be great for our listeners to hear, like, what's the recipe for that? How did you all pull that off?
Well, I think first of all, what I want to say in answer to that question is that I started a nonprofit organization because I thought that doing this network building was at least a full-time job for one person. And I don't have a trust fund, so I needed an entity through which I could raise money. But that being said, I don't necessarily think that a nonprofit organizations are the best structure for creating transformational social change. So if I, and I respect people who utilize different models. I have a great deal of respect for different models. I do not think that nonprofits are the be all and end all. I think they're deeply problematic and they often end up recreating all sorts of harmful dynamics that exist in the private sector.
Oh my
Um,
goodness.
and I, and I think
Thanks for
that the,
naming that.
yeah, I do want to name
We have to
that. And
name that.
yeah, and I also want to say that, the power dynamics between philanthropy and nonprofits are often harmful. So I just want to name those realities and say that it's not a perfect structure. By any means. And, there could be a whole other podcast analyzing, the challenges of working within the structure of a nonprofit when you're trying to create really a different world and a
Yeah.
paradigm shift, which I
Totally.
think is what a lot of us who do this work are about. But that being said, I thought it was important to have a container through which I could bring people together. And eventually, 5 years in, I was able to begin hiring some staff. So we have a little bit of specialization within our organization, people who focus on different things. And we at a certain point in the beginning, we weren't focused on training because there were a number of other organizations and entities and individuals out there who were offering circle keeping training and other types of training in restorative practices. But a lot of those trainings are kind of they're focused on like developing a set of skills or tools. And you might sit in circle or be part of a cohort while you're in the training, but then at the end of the training, that's it. Maybe they give you a certificate, or maybe not. They send you on your way and they say, good luck to you. And what we were hearing back from people in our community was, I'm really interested in restorative justice, and I actually went to this training. I went to this training a few years ago, and the training was really great, and I felt so inspired, and I met these wonderful people. And then after the training, I couldn't really figure out how to apply what I had learned in my life and in my work, or I didn't feel like I had enough support to practice or enough opportunities to practice what I had learned in the training. And so we decided that we were going to start offering trainings utilizing a cohort model. And so when you sign up for a training with us, you sign up for it's a minimum 6 month commitment, and you're going to be with a group of other learners throughout the process. And the goal is that you are building skills, practical skills to facilitate restoratively during the workshop or training modules. And then you are having opportunities to practice circle keeping yourself within your cohort. And then the hope that we hold out for our cohorts is that they will continue to self-organize, convene, and convene together as a community of practice over time, so that as people continue to learn, deepen their practice, they are always doing that within a peer network.
This is so
So,
powerful to hear.
yeah.
I knew you were doing great things, but I wasn't like this detail really adds to like please listeners, check into this because this is actually the way to really support a feeling of truly enacting the practices, like you said earlier, instead of it being like a one-off training or a piece of paper, a certificate, which that's a whole other podcast, right? And it is a, there is value deeply of education and certificates, of course. But in the case of restorative practices, that's been a debate here in Colorado for a long time. And we actually, our coalition here does not provide certificates for the very reasons that you are stating. That we steward each other as a cohort, we stay together, and we feel a sense that, okay, I think I might be ready to go out into the world and enact these practices together with others and still have a sense that you're connected with a community of like-minded practitioners who are also doing the same thing. That's a that's that and it returns us to a model of apprenticeship, and
Yes.
that this is like an ongoing lifelong commitment. It's not a one-off thing, which I, you
Yes.
know, I'm guilty of probably being perceived at times of giving one-offs, even though I strive to not do that, because of the fact that it's very difficult to provide services like what you're doing unless there is committed funding and funders who see the value of what
Yeah.
you're doing. So this again, to my point earlier as to why RJI needs community support more than ever, especially in these times. And
Yeah.
this is another point to that, you know, to that reasoning.
Yeah, I love that you brought up the concept of apprenticeship because I think that's really important and really needed in this field. And I'm pretty certain that the reason it doesn't happen more often is exactly what you just named, that the most experienced practitioners within our network can't get paid to mentor the next generation of practitioners. And
Exactly.
is a real missed opportunity. That is a real loss.
That is so true. And it also is true that practitioners that are independent, you know, in the field, many, many deeply seasoned, very wise beings who know what, who know very well how to help keep a circle together with others. It's very difficult to get paid and recognized, you know, if it's if you decide that this is something that you would like to do as a profession and a main living, it is challenging. It's I think the recognition that I just spoke to, I'll complete that thought, meaning more not recognition but more valuation, you know. Because oftentimes we're called upon as independent practitioners and facilitators, if we're not with a nonprofit at the time, working, like I've worked alongside courts as an executive director of a program here in Colorado. I'm not doing that any longer. I'm, you know, I respond to requests if I'm the right person to facilitate, but it's still very undervalued that, you know, we are legit. We are doing equal work to the great work of mediators and ADR attorneys, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, Molly, while we're truth telling around the economics of being a restorative practitioner, I'm gonna share something that I shared at once at a meeting of at an event that was hosted by funders, and somebody in my network just recently reminded me of this. You know, I've heard other people say it too, but I find it really galling that we as restorative practitioners are held to a much higher standard of proof than the current practices within the criminal legal system, just to take that system as one example, right? I mean, anybody who has, you know, done any study of the criminal legal system knows that by any measure, it has an abysmal rate of failure. It does not accomplish the goals that it purports to accomplish whatsoever. So, and yet, when we are talking to as restorative practitioners, when we're talking to funders, potential funders, to system partners about the value of restorative justice and restorative practices, we are constantly being asked for evidence of its efficacy. We are constantly being asked for data to support, you know, making an investment in this approach. And I understand the value of data. I understand the value of evidence-based
Course.
practices. There is a lot of data out there, by the way, already, that speaks to the efficacy of these practices.
And not just US based, like
And
global
not just US,
statistics
global.
and evidence
Yes,
are quite similar. There is
absolutely.
a very similar and very strong evidence that
Yeah.
this works. Yes.
Yes, this it's important to say also in the, you and I are both here in the United States, but this work has been, restorative justice in its sort of modern iteration
Yeah.
has been employed in other countries outside of the
Absolutely.
US in their justice systems to great effect for much longer than it has
Absolutely.
been
Yeah.
here. So there is a long body of
Yes.
evidence, not to mention the much, we go even further back in time, the, all of the indigenous practices that are the origin of this work, indigenous societies around the world,
Absolutely.
community justice practices, that are, that were effective long before, colonization and the adversarial, justice system as we know it today was imposed on those people and cultures. So
Absolutely.
there's plenty of
Well
evidence,
said.
and I think we should really be questioning why we're held to a higher standard of proof and evidence than the system that is currently receiving, all of the funding and support. And while I'm talking about that, I also want to say that I really would like for us as a movement to move away from the language of being an alternative to. Right? I mean, so often in schools, we
Absolutely.
talk about this work as an alternative to punitive or exclusionary discipline, talk about it
Right,
In
ADR.
the context of alternatives to
Yep.
incarceration,
Yep.
that is not the vision.
No.
The vision is not that punishment comes first and restorative justice is an alternative. That's not my vision anyway, and I think it's
Well, and you're
probably
not
not
alone.
yours, Molly.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's giving voice back to the people. And that's why we're about to feature Anuj and RJI on the Community Held Restorative Justice series, speaker series, because of that fact that and for example, your work, Oregon's work, Colorado's work, like there's a lot of course, gray areas, even with people doing this type of intentional work, where it is very, very difficult on the ground to build relationships of trust with the beast, really. Like this, the criminal justice system is doing exactly what it's designed to do. It is not broken. It is not broken. We have to get over this idea that it's broken and that we're trying to step in and provide an quote unquote alternative. It is by design the way it is. I speak as the daughter of a 15-year incarcerated mother. I've seen it from the inside. I know a lot of you have of our listeners, like, and I know that there's loved ones on the inside right now who, and those circles of impact continue to perpetuate harm and violence, and they're unjust. So there's so much to unpack with your whole point. I wish we had, like, we should probably do a series of conversations and really flesh out each of these topics. But I didn't, let's come back to your point. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I don't think you did. I feel like my point was basically complete.
So the community voice, and the ostentatious level, really, of having to justify restorative practices as legit. I think that's what I was hearing, and that's very powerful, and I really appreciate you naming that. And honoring and naming cultures from all around the world who didn't even call this justice. That it was their
That's
way
right.
of being.
That's right.
I mean, on the African continent, a child is known by their song even before they're born. In many villages, they sing to to the fetus before it's even born. It's song. And when it's born, they sing the child's song on the first day of their life, when they possibly and potentially cause harm in the community. They bring that person back in a circle and sing their song back to them. So there's so much beauty in this world and elements that we don't have to name as restorative justice necessarily, but that are that too. And I know that you're very passionate as well as I am about the fact that also, what are we doing in our networking and conversations to really step back and say, wait a minute, the first harm and slavery, if we're restorative justice practitioners, what is our responsibility to the unhealed, unacknowledged, open wounds on the land that we're sitting on right now?
Absolutely, especially in this country and especially at this moment in time when I
Absolutely.
feel like we just see those unhealed wounds festering in a particularly destructive way.
Mika, do you think that that we can pull it together to unify? Like, how do we unify even within the restorative justice movement? You talked about silos and the moment of time that we're in. Like, I've heard takes from Indigenous elders that are mentors to even our greatest guides in this field, like Kay, just say, it's kind of too late to like talk about, for example, co-option, which is a legitimate thing to consider. Like, cultural respect is very, very important. Being humble, listening, and yet, like, from an Indigenous person themselves saying, wait a minute, circle is everybody's. Let's and we have to get it out there. Like, it's kind of overly urgent at this point.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, and let me, I'll get back to your question about, whether I think we can unify, but the piece about humility and circle belonging to everyone, I think one of the things that capitalism has wrought is that people often feel that in order to turn this into a business and a viable source of income, they have to sort of put their own brand on it, and create their own model, their own copyrighted
Right, the little
material.
circle with the C.
And I just also really want to encourage all of us to question that instinct.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, thank you.
it's been really important to me in the network building that I've been doing in New York for the past decade that we are creating a big tent.
Mm.
And like you said, we do highlight best practices, but we're not policing who's restorative, who's not restorative, who's more restorative or less restorative. We're not, we're not creating, we're not ultimately, creating a hierarchy or a value for some applications or some models over others. And I think that's really important. So I hope that anyone who's listening to this, who is part of a restorative network or looking to create a restorative network in their area, will take that to heart. That it's not your job to, figure out who is in and who is out. It is your job to create a space where people who are called to this type of practice, and they may be using different terms for it, and they may be applying it in all sorts of different settings. But, values-based, community-led, giving voice to community members, all where all of those elements are present, where people are being offered an opportunity to take meaningful accountability for harm, where those elements are present, that we invite people in. And, if there are things that are harmful that we become aware of that are harmful, that are happening in the within those organizations or within those practices, we find a way to call each other in, and to hold accountability processes and to name those things and move people toward best practices, but not that we're not denigrating each other's work, that we're really valuing and lifting up everybody's work, and there's not a sense that, one organization or one practitioner is doing this the right way. Anytime you hear that kind of language, that to me is a red flag. That this is a individual or an organization that doesn't actually isn't deeply rooted in the values of this work.
That's so beautifully put. And I also, if I might add, just my passion is to equally honor programs such as IARP, EMU, and their incredible Summer Peacebuilding Institute and their trauma responsive and school-based train, like there's so much richness to the academic angle that you can then take with you to also enjoy grassroots hands-on experiences. So there's a place for the grassroots that's very important and also, I believe, undervalued in this field of, like these are people who are living the experience of actual facilitation. Some on a very daily, regular, hourly basis of all kinds of needs that are being answered to and served harms or non-conflict style spaces that are equally important, if not more important, right? But the grassroots, like the facilitation trainings that people are offering. There's so many of them now. And if it's coming from a grassroots organization that's actually doing the work, it can really complement what you may have received from, a certificate or graduate or undergrad program. And I feel strongly that the equal valuation is very important. And it speaks to your cohort model of apprenticeship, of stewardship together, of gaining experience as much as possible that's hands-on and that can respond to a lot of multiple realities going on. You know, we know that there's, you know, a wide spectrum of realities arriving at the door when we respond to a harm case. And we hope to be prepared for that and grounded in ourselves, right? And together as a team. And that's what you're doing. You're creating a bridge between the grassroots, the academic, the people who are seeking and hungry to understand how they can plug in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, people who are really drawn to this work and committed to it often engage in restorative practice in a range of contexts, both, you know, professional contexts and personal contexts throughout their lives and throughout their careers. So, you know, there are people in our network who, you know, used to work in government, in city or state government, and now they, you know, now they're in the private sector, or they're in academia, or they're doing community-based work, and, you know, and vice versa. So I think it is important to, you know, support the people who are called to this work, regardless of their particular, you know, their current context. You asked me a question earlier
About
about
unification.
unification. That's a really big question, which
It
I
sure
don't,
is. There's no shortage of answers.
which I don't know if I can, I don't know if I can answer, because I don't have a crystal ball. But what I do believe, I believe that the work of restorative practices, and particularly sitting in circle, I think that that is an essential practice for healing and building a sustainable future. And I think everybody in the world needs to have more opportunity to sit together with people of like mind, but also people of vastly different lived experience, different worldview, across identities, and even, dare I say, across disagreement. You know, when we sit together and we share our stories, there is, we are eventually going to find the nugget of shared humanity that allows us to connect. And that is what we need. That is what needs to be happening. And, you know, I'm going to try not to sound too much like a Gen X Luddite, but here, but social media, I believe, bears a lot of responsibility for the fracturing, that we see in our civil society and in our politics, and the polarization. Because of the way, you know, because of what drives those algorithms. And I think, so I think it's, and because those interactions on social media are not in person, they're not face to face, it almost seems like people feel more empowered to mistreat others.
Dehumanize, yeah.
And so I really,
Divide. It serves division.
So I think that anything we can do, that brings people into a room together face to face, slowing down,
Yeah.
You
Slowing down.
know, really sharing our stories and listening to one another deeply, because I think listening is absolutely a lost art. Listening to, you know, to really hear and connect rather than listening to respond, you know, or listening to argue. Is really a really important skill set. And I think those are
Absolutely.
things that restorative practices and restorative practitioners really can help to support people to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listening that is true quality listening is also a neuroscientific flex that transforms a moment that is in mainly the unspoken. And I couldn't agree with you more that I think there's still cultures around the world who know how to listen well and who value it in the way that I think it should be valued. It's transformational when it's offered as an extension of self to be curious about the story of another instead of reactive, like you said. So it opens up new
That's
gateways
beautiful.
of understanding. Instead of closing them down or even causing violence.
Yeah, I
So
love that.
I mean what you're saying, I want everyone to hear Mika, like what you're speaking to around the slow movement. You know, th this is connecting us with our earth who shows us, thank goodness for Mother Earth. Like without her, we would not be here. She's showing us all the time that there is a time and a place for, you know, winter, spring, summer, and fall. A flower does not bloom overnight. You know, there's logic and harmony in slowing down. And I love how you pointed out how social media has been detrimental. I believe that tech, phones, which have appeared unfortunately to the level that they have. When you go to an airport, you see people basically with their heads down in their tech. And it was not always like this. For
That's right.
those of you who are listening who may not necessarily have that experience, I can reassure you that there is a world that got along really well without the presence of cell phones. And that world was also about what you're speaking to, about really opening up a field of listening and dialogue and storytelling of person-to-person interaction. And I miss that world. I feel like restorative justice, actually, our practices, whether they're conflict or community building, one and the same, have the opportunity to reinstill that. And especially in our broken country, where the outpicturing of capitalism, of technocracy is so startlingly and, you know, scarily apparent, you know? So, excuse me for going off, but like really,
By all means.
you're making so many points here today that are so needing to be named and then to be brought forward. Like this practice is much more than just something that we do when conflict happens. It's something that can completely remap how we relate. And it's not too late,
Right.
right?
That's right.
Not too late.
And also I want to say that it's been my experience by, you know, creating this hub, you know, putting it out there, that people are hungry for this.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
they are really hungry for these practices. I remember early on in my restorative justice learning journey, another practitioner based in New York City said to me, "You know, I don't think this is ever going to take off here because New Yorkers will never be able to slow down enough to embrace restorative
Of all the places, right? And yet.
And, you know, I will not deny that there is a constant tension, or at least negotiation, particularly for folks who are trying to build restorative practices within systems, between, sort of the urgency and the pace at which the systems move.
Which are
And
based in total colonization,
exactly. And the
as per Tema Okun.
exactly. And again, that sort of focus on result, like quick results. And but that being said, I have found that the New Yorkers who find their way to restorative justice initiative and that resonate with our mission are eager to for this kind of space that restorative practices provide, the space and the deepening of connection, because we don't have nearly enough opportunities as we, hurry through our daily lives in the great metropolis to do that.
Gosh, there's so many areas that we could unpack today, and I know. On that note, oftentimes with podcasting, it's difficult for to keep people listening for an entire hour. So we're going to wrap up, but with an ask that you go over to restorativejustice.nyc and you click the monthly donation agreement or a one-time donation. I especially encourage monthly donations for this 10-year project. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary. We've been talking with Mika Dashman, of course, who is the founding director. But check out the website. Please, if you're in the New York area or internationally even, support this work. Support this very key link and bridge between guides, practitioners, a palette of various programs, resources, and volunteer opportunities. There's a litany of things that are being offered here, and for you also to plug in, support their work. Monthly donation of even, $20 a month, $10 a month, like that's $110 a year. That adds up quickly if there's 100 people that can do that, or more. So thank you so much for supporting this essential platform in its 10th year. And Mika, thank you to you. Just have so thoroughly enjoyed hearing the origin story, which I'd never heard before, and also everything that we covered today. It's been so rich. So thank you.
Thank you, Molly. I'm so glad we did this.
Me too. I'm looking forward to hearing people's feedback. Again, please check out the RJ on the Rise website as well, but primarily go and give your donation right now before you forget. Go to the Restorative Justice Initiative. There's a donate button that pops up right away. It's a very simple, easy form. If you have any questions, Mika, who do we contact at RJI?
There's a contact form on the website which
Perfect.
you can use, and you can also always email info@restorativejustice.nyc.
Thank you. And here's to the next 10 years, Mika. I appreciate you so
Thank you so
much.
much, Molly.
This has
Appreciate you.
been. This has been a 10-year anniversary celebration episode of Restorative Justice on the Rise, celebrating our colleague and partner along the way in this field, the Restorative Justice Initiative, featuring the founding director again, Mika Dashman. We'll see you next time.